From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, This Boy's Life, we feature an interview with writer Tobias Wolff. His memoir, This Boy's Life, is the basis of the new film starring Robert De Niro and Ellen Barkin. Also, we meet stand-up comic Leah Delaria. She recently performed on the Arsenio Hall show, becoming the first comic on a national late-night show to do an act about being a lesbian. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new book by Croatian journalist Slavinka Draculic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN officials said today that they'll reconvene the international peace talks on Bosnia this weekend in Greece. The latest move is a response to the Bosnian Serbs, who've promised to reconsider the UN-sponsored peace plan at a meeting next week. UN spokesman Fred Eckhard said all three parties, Muslims, Croats, and Serbs, have accepted the invitation to meet in Athens on Saturday and Sunday. The Bosnian Serbs rejected the UN plan on Monday, but the Serbian government is reportedly putting pressure on them to reconsider. British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd said today that his country would not agree to any action in Bosnia that would put British forces in serious risk. His comments came as Western allies continued an open debate on policy options in the Balkans. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from London.
The debate today in the British Parliament reflected a rift with Washington that's sharpened this week. Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd called for a political rather than a military solution in Bosnia, as Washington policymakers considered lifting the UN arms embargo or dropping bombs on Serbian supply lines. Douglas Hurd made it clear that his government was strongly against lifting the arms embargo, and there were suggestions in London today from high-ranking British officials that Britain would use its veto at the Security Council if Washington raised the matter in New York. The U.S. ambassador to Britain attended the session in London. Meanwhile, British troops in Bosnia are preparing for the worst after Bosnian Serbs threatened to attack them in the event of Western airstrikes. Serbian artillery positions are within 10 miles of British troops. The French moved U.N. troops out of the Serbian capital today. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
Today, the Senate Armed Services Committee held another in a series of hearings on homosexuals in the military. The focus was on the experience of those countries that allow gays and lesbians to serve in uniform. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
According to the panel of experts who testified before the committee, the lesson to be learned from foreign militaries is mixed. While it's true that in Israel, Germany, France, Canada, the Netherlands, and many other countries, homosexuality is no barrier to service, Charlie Moskos, a sociologist at Northwestern University, says that's not the full picture.
If we look at other countries' lessons, most of them do discriminate against gays one way or the other, except for a handful in Northwest Europe. But from across the board in democratic armies, there is some kind of differential treatment.
On the other hand, militaries that allow gays find that they don't present any significant problems. Many senators expressed an interest in a compromise for the U.S. in which the military wouldn't ask about homosexuality and gays wouldn't flaunt their sexual orientation. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 11 points to close at 3,425. This is NPR. Costa Rican police say they've captured the five gunmen who held most of the country's Supreme Court hostage for 3 days. The gunmen had already released 18 justices and 5 court employees and were on their way to an airport near San Jose, where officials had apparently promised them a flight out of the country. Officials say the men were captured after a brief gun battle near the airport. They said no one was hurt in the shooting. The gunmen had been demanding $8 million and safe passage to Brazil. The number of new AIDS cases reported in the first 3 months of 1993 increased more than 200% compared to the same period last year. Federal health officials say the sharp rise is due mostly to the recently expanded definition of AIDS. NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
From January through March this year, almost 36,000 new AIDS cases were reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. During the same time period last year, only 12,000 new cases were reported. The CDC says it expected an increase in the number of AIDS cases because of the new definition of AIDS, which went into effect January 1st. The revised definition expands the criteria that doctors use to diagnose someone as having AIDS. The CDC attributes most of the increase to the new definition, but says the number of cases increased above and beyond what can be explained by the change. The CDC says that shows the disease is continuing to spread. According to the CDC, the total number of AIDS cases reported this year will increase by about 75%. This is Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
The U.S. economy lost momentum in the first quarter of the year, slowing after a surge of growth in the last 3 months of 1992. The Commerce Department said the gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of only 1.8% in the first quarter. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, This Boy's Life, starring Robert De Niro and Ellen Barkin, is based on a memoir by Tobias Wolff. It's one of the books I often mention when friends ask me to recommend something to read. So I thought whether or not you've seen the film, you might enjoy listening to our interview with Wolff from 1989, when his memoir was first published. Wolff's memoir is something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey Wolff's acclaimed book, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father. The father was a con man who fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel manners, how to shoot and handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. Jeffrey's memoir is about discovering his father was a fraud. Tobias's memoir is about traveling with a loving mother who wanted to make a new life but kept getting involved with abusive men. Tobias Wolff is now a professor at Syracuse University. We'll get started with a reading from the opening of his memoir, This Boy's Life.
Our car boiled over again just after my mother and I crossed the Continental Divide. While we were waiting for it to cool, we heard, from somewhere above us, the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past us into the next curve, its trailer shimmying wildly. We stared after it. "Oh, Toby," my mother said. "He's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, then faded in the wind that sighed in the trees all around us. By the time we got there, quite a few people were standing along the cliff where the truck went over. It had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. It looked pitifully small. A stream of thick black smoke rose from the cab, feathering out in the wind. My mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. We stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. My mother put her arm around my shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at me, touching me, brushing back my hair. I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs. I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck.
One of the things I really like about that beginning is the sense of disaster can happen in any second. A trunk could just lose its brakes and go over the cliff. And your mother's going to try to be a good mother, and you're going to be a kid. I mean, it's just out of control. You're a kid. You're going to manipulate her to get that souvenir.
That's right. Yeah. It's an emblem of the book, in a way, that episode. We still talk about that episode. It made such an indelible impression on us. But
Why did it?
Well, we were so full of hope and going to this new life, and just for a moment there, we were too foolish for our optimism ever to get dampened for long, but just for a moment there, we tasted it, you know. We tasted our mortality, and we tasted the vanity of our hopes, seeing this man who probably was very hopeful himself about getting home for dinner that night, finishing his run, suddenly have everything go wrong on him. And I've never forgotten it. I can still see his face in the windshield.
You talked about how this memoir for you is really about coming of age, finding out who you are, who you want to be, and trying to become that. Your father transformed himself through lying, through making up a false history, through making up lineage that he didn't have, through even lying about his furniture and where that came from, making things into antiques that weren't.
Right.
Your mother wanted to transform herself and wanted to change her luck, but the way she ended up actually taking action was to hook up with different men.
Yes.
And all of those men ended up being disasters. They abused both your mother and you. And she seemed to really be unaware that that was going to happen each time she'd meet a new man. But you seemed to always know.
No, I didn't always know this was going to happen until it happened. I in a sense conspired in this by not learning my lesson either. We went from one man like this to another. It's true. But I think that what's more important than this is what we made of these situations. I mean, it's true that we drifted into these rather violent and frightening situations sometimes together, but we always kept faith with each other, and we kept our pluck, and we changed our luck again and again. We reinvented the circumstances. We'd go somewhere else and try again, and eventually, oddly enough, we were right. It worked. We both translated ourselves to different people and to better lives.
When you were young and you were in the Boy Scouts, you liked to really read the Boy Scouts magazine, Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that really appeal to you? Your life was very different from the kind of mainstream view of what a Boy Scout should be, the good and healthy, wholesome life.
Yeah, that's right. I think that when I was reading it, I fell into a kind of spell in which I believed I was those boys that the magazine was about, these boys who saved lives and had trap lines in the Arctic, and boys who built airplanes in their backyards and flew them at state fairs, as extraordinary young entrepreneurs. And while I was reading this magazine, I felt like I was participating in this ideal American boyhood that all the movies I went to and the television shows and the radio shows that I listened to sort of invited us all to believe we were living. Yeah, so that magazine was very, very important to me in that way when I was young. That's why I called this memoir of mine This Boy's Life. It's to distinguish between that ideal boyhood of the, you know, of Norman Rockwell, the kind of pictures that Norman Rockwell would draw of young of childhood, and the kind that I and in fact most of the boys I knew when I was growing up actually lived.
You really wanted to have a conventional life and a conventional family.
Sure. Sure, I think it's a real cycle. I think that children who grow up in safe, secure, conventional, middle-class families all want to become outlaws and
right.
rebels and live in dirty apartments and never do the dishes. And and children who grow up chaotically and in poverty and who have no automatic hold on respectability in the world come to prize conventionality and security. Yes, that's what I wanted when I don't want it so much anymore, I think, but I sure did want it when I was a boy.
Your mother wanted a good family that spent time together also, and I really like what you write about that. You say, Mother insisted we spend time together like a real family. Our failure was ordained because the real family we set out to imitate doesn't exist in nature. A real family as troubled as ours would never dream of spending time together.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that line. That's right.
But how much of that charade did you go through?
Well, we had our rich. This was the life I led with my first stepfather and his family, and that we led with them. And we did. We had these rituals of family life, and they were they gave us for a little while the appearance, and we actually probably believed that we were a real family when we would sit together and watch Lawrence Welk. I can't think hear the name today without wilting. Mitch something in the sing-along
Mitch
gang.
Mitch Miller.
He used to make us watch Mitch Miller. We'd all sit around. That was our idea of a family evening, is sitting in front of the tube and watching Lawrence Welk and Mitch Miller. And he'd stepfather would get his old saxophone out and sit there oh, Lord. Don't make me relive it again.
I don't know. You've just been through it in your book, although you left out that particular story.
The Mitch Miller one I left out, but I've got Lawrence Welk in there all right.
Right. Tobias Wolff is my guest, and his new memoir is called This Boy's Life. There's a scene that you describe. One of the father figures in your life, one of the men that your mother had hooked up with for a while, gave you a Winchester, a rifle. And one day you were leaning out the window, aiming the rifle out the window, pointing at a couple who were walking by. And you pulled the trigger and actually didn't shoot the couple. You shot a squirrel. But in describing that scene, in reading that scene, I couldn't help but wonder whether, looking back, you think you were ever on the verge of really becoming one of those neighbors next door who goes nuts and kills somebody?
Well, in a way, I guess the point of that scene is that anybody can become someone like that almost inadvertently. It's funny. My friends, when they've read that section, the men, not the women, have almost all said to me, incidentally, I did not. I was not aiming the rifle at these people when I pulled the trigger. I was aiming at something else. But it is true that I used to aim the rifle out the window at people walking past. And every boy I know who grew up in a house where there were weapons did things like that. They've all told me that. It is a very typical thing. What do you think kids do with those things? They watch, the things we watch in the movies and TV kind of take away our sense of mortality, that, you know, that things don't have consequences when you point guns at people. There, you'll see them next week on another show. And we have an infatuation in this country with firearms and handling them. And boys left alone in a house, I think girls are not so interested in them, but boys left alone in a house with a weapon are going to get that weapon out and they're going to point it.
Your memoir, This Boy's Life, is about how you invented and reinvented yourself. And perhaps the most stunning reinvention of yourself that you're responsible for is how you got into prep school. Just to explain here, although your father had for a while been rich, your mother, who you were with, was always poor. And when you were in, I guess it was junior high school, you and your brother started communicating. And your brother urged you to try to get away from your father, your stepfather, who was beating you, and try to get into prep school. And he said he'd try to help you. So you got really hooked on the idea and tried to get a scholarship. So what you did was you made up letters of recommendations from all of your teachers. And you tried to really write it in their tone of voice. And you wrote, "And on the boy who lived in their letters, the splendid phantom who carried all my hopes, it seemed to me at last I saw my own face." And I thought that's so convincing that you were really, truly writing letters about the boy who you think you were or deserved to be as a boy, as opposed to the boy who you were forced to become.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all have a kind of dream self. Mm-hmm. And in writing those, my actual self, I'm afraid, wasn't quite the boy that I portrayed in those letters. I was a very indifferent student in a very bad school, and lazy, and I didn't even go to school a lot of the time. I hung out with a bad bunch, and I mean, they were actually good guys, really, looking back on it, but they were considered a bad bunch then. And I was no model of American boyhood, and I had to get a scholarship to this prep school, and it was quite clear to me that being the boy I was, in fact, was not going to get me in. I couldn't even get a letter of recommendation from my teachers, so I decided to take this task on myself. What did I have to lose, right? I'd end up, if I lost, being where I was. So I basically wrote down in these letters of recommendation that I made up a picture of the boy that I dreamed I really was if everybody just knew me actually as well as I knew myself. And you know, the straight A student, the Eagle Scout, upright fellow, and manufactured this identity and did it, I guess, persuasively enough, since I did get a scholarship to a fine prep school, which changed my life completely.
Did you do a convincing job of reinventing yourself at prep school because you had to pretend to be the boy who you had described in these letters, the boy who got you into this school?
No, it didn't hold up very well. For one thing, coming from such a lousy school as I was coming from, and not having been a good student at that school anyway, I didn't know very much. I was very ignorant, and my teachers were puzzled at how little I knew, considering the brilliant transcripts that came in. I had a friend in the school office at that school who gave me the school transcript form, so I made out my own grades, and I awarded myself straight A's and in courses that I hadn't even taken in order to get in. So I didn't know very much. I had a terrible time academically at the school, but an English teacher there took me under his wing and tutored me and gave me books, and I was excited about reading anyway, but he taught me to be a systematic and careful reader, and he excited me about writing, as indeed my brother had also, and really brought me along. It was the pivotal experience of my life being at that school and being under that man's tutelage. And I owe, you know, just all kinds of things to him for that. So it turned out to be a wonderful, almost fairy tale escape for me. And I loved the school, but no, the act didn't hold up. And eventually it fell apart. And I was, in my senior year there, in my last year, my sixth form year, I was asked to leave.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with Tobias Wolff. His 1989 memoir, This Boy's Life, is the basis of the new film of the same name, starring Robert De Niro and Ellen Barkin. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Tobias Wolff, we were just talking about how you lied your way into prep school, but eventually got thrown out. Do you believe in lying when it's the only way to get what you need, and when you know that ultimately you're not telling a terrible mistruth, that it won't be a malicious mistruth?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer, I'm committed to truth. I mean, in this book about a boy who lies, I am very scrupulous in telling the truth, and the book is in a lot of ways about the cost of not telling the truth. So no, ultimately I think lies subtract from your substance as a person, and the more of them you tell, the more you beggar yourself. But I will distinguish between lying and invention, and especially self-invention. Children need to try on different selves. They don't know who they are. They try different things. You'll see the way kids change their hair constantly, you know, their hairdos, and experiment with their clothes and all that. It's really all sort of fumbling around trying to figure out who they are. And so there's a period when you're young when I think especially parents have to be very careful not to apply standards about lying to what is naturally occurring in the child's life in terms of just figuring out who they are and trying on different selves. And sometimes that involves acts of self-invention. And I think that, that we have to be very tolerant about that.
Even when you're trying very hard to tell the truth, there are so many different versions of the truth. Did you run into that when writing this memoir? I think you gave the manuscript to your mother and to your brother and to others to read before
it
was published.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to be sure that when it came out, they wouldn't say, oh, no, this is, not to others, but to me, you've got it all wrong. And I was very gratified that they were very impressed by the accuracy of the record and that it really squared with their own recollections. My mother had some questions about chronology. She has a wonderful kind of memory, and she says, here and there, I got things switched around and whatnot, but nothing serious at all. And basically, I let those things stand because that's the way I remembered them, and that's the story I'm telling, is what my memory tells me. You can follow someone around with a camera and a notebook and a tape recorder, and you'll get a lot of facts, but you won't get the truth. The truth lies in the memory, and because that's the story you tell yourself about who you are and where you come from, where you've been. And so I was very attentive to my memory and trusted that.
You and your brother have both written memoirs about your childhood. You've read each other's books, and you've become very close over the years, even though you were separated from each other during childhood.
Maybe that's why we're close.
Did you ever go through a period of envying each other's lives? Did you ever wish you'd stayed with your father? Did your father ever wish he'd stayed with your mother? Did he ever wish he was poor, like you were often poor? Did you ever wish that you had money like he did?
I can't speak for him. I don't think that he ever wished to be poor. I don't think anybody ever wished to be poor. But I certainly spent a lot of time wishing I was rich. And my father was a very charismatic guy. Though I hardly knew him, I remembered him well. I could remember the sort of tobacco smell that used to cling to his tweeds. And he had a deep, grumbling voice, and he was big and had a very bearish kind of presence. And I remember lying in my bed at night and hearing his voice come through the bedroom wall, that rumble of his, and I'd how secure I'd feel hearing that. So there were, you know, I longed to be with my father, not to be with my mother, but to be with my father also. And I romanticized him and idealized him.
We were talking about lies before. What was the most damaging lie that your father told you?
It wasn't so much lies he told me, but truths that he did not tell me. I was led to believe by him that we came from an aristocratic family, and that, he had coats of arms and all this, and my mother was Irish Catholic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and he objected to this. He said his family had always been Episcopalians and everything. Well, it turned out my father's family were a wonderful Jewish family of doctors and brilliant surgeons with their own claim to respect and stature, which he and some he didn't want to be Jewish, and he cut my brother and I off not only from that knowledge but from the knowledge of that of his wonderful family because he didn't want us to understand this about him and consequently about ourselves. And so we lost that half of our family, when my brother went back to write about my father and interviewed these people, they were wonderful people, and it broke our hearts that we had been denied their company when we were growing up and the richness of that life that they had in Hartford. So, you know, his lies had terrible, terrible consequences on us, as his absence did on me. That's partly what this book is about. I don't romanticize lying in this book. I talk about self-invention. I talk about lies, and the lies, you know, the big lies in this book cause inestimable harm.
This is, I believe, the first really autobiographical thing that you've written. You've written stories about other people, and they are indirectly autobiographical. But this is direct. Autobiography.
Yes,
do you feel exposed by it? What's the experience been for you?
Yes, I do. In the past, when people are, as I say, the way we're talking right now, if I'm being interviewed about a collection of stories or a novel that I've written, people will talk about the characters, and it's quite clear these are characters, these are inventions, even though obviously they may spring from some origin in my life. We're talking about figures in a book. And now when we're talking about this book, you know, clearly we're talking about me, or at least my idea of who I am and the people I've known. And yes, I do feel vulnerable. I think I'd be crazy if I didn't.
One last thing. Do you think that your writing changed at all, that the voice you used was different because you were writing in first person?
Yes. Yes, it was different. It's a little fuller. I tend to have I think it's a warmer voice. It tends to be I tended to really pull out the stops when I wrote this. I just imagined talking to a great friend, you know, when I was writing this book, and let it rip.
Tobias Wolff, recruited in 1989 after the publication of his memoir, This Boy's Life. That memoir is the basis of the new film of the same name, starring Robert De Niro and Ellen Barkin. The book is out in a new paperback edition, published by Harper Perennial. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Leah Delaria about being a Bull Dyke comic with a voice for torch songs. After playing to primarily gay audiences for many years, she was recently on the Arsenio Hall show and is working on an off-Broadway show. And critic John Leonard reviews The Balkan Express, a new book by the Croatian journalist Slavenka Dracolic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The nation's economy slowed dramatically during the first 3 months of this year. But as NPR's John Itzie reports, economists say that there's little likelihood that the nation will slip back into recession.
The numbers are quite stark. The annualized rate of growth dropped from 4.7% last autumn to 1.8% in the first 3 months of this year. And the decline was sharper than economists had predicted. A big slowdown in consumer spending had been expected after the Christmas shopping spree and the blizzard that kept shoppers at home. The big surprise was a huge drop in defense spending. While it's on a long-term downward trend, the record drop in the first quarter was probably an aberration, according to economists. Of greater concern was a buildup in inventories. In fact, if you didn't count what was made and put on the shelf, there would have been no growth at all in the first quarter. And the stocked shelves will likely slow production and growth in the coming months. Still, many economists predict growth for the rest of the year will rebound to a moderate rate of 2.5% to 3%. I'm John Itzie in Washington.
3 days after turning down a UN-backed peace plan and amidst growing fears of Western military intervention, Bosnian Serbs announced today that their self-styled parliament will reconsider the peace package. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
The announcement came after Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic met in Belgrade with Serbian hardline president Slobodan Milosevic, widely seen as the sponsor of the Bosnian Serbs. On Monday, only 2 hours before a UN deadline to accept the plan, Milosevic had sent a letter to the so-called Bosnian Serb parliament urging the deputies to sign the peace deal brokered by the UN and the European Community. But the assembly rejected the appeal, triggering the introduction of extremely harsh sanctions against Serbia and its ally Montenegro. The rejection of the plan by the Bosnian Serb deputies, who will meet again on May 5th, has been severely criticized by Serbia's government-controlled media. There is speculation in Belgrade that Milosevic may have threatened the Bosnian Serbs with cutting off vital supplies and perhaps even military aid. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
UN officials say that Bosnian peace talks will resume Saturday in Athens. In London, British officials continue to argue that lifting an arms embargo against Muslim factions in Bosnia would add to the conflict. However, Foreign Secretary Hurd told Parliament that the question will not lead to an impasse with U.S. officials. President Clinton has said that he will make up his mind soon and then consult with Western allies. Under consideration are plans to end the arms ban and airstrikes against Serbian positions in Bosnia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 11 points to close at 3,425.12 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin told local officials today that in the wake of a vote of confidence this last weekend, everyone must understand that the president and his moves to a free market economy enjoy the protection of the Russian people. In Sunday's non-binding vote, 58% of those taking part indicated their support for Yeltsin, and 53% backed his policies. However, one government official said today that there must be fast movement or public confidence will drop. Yeltsin reportedly told his cabinet that all opponents of reform should leave the government because there is no time to educate them. On Capitol Hill, House Democrats today pushed through a bill that would give the president a modified version of the line item veto after defeating a Republican effort to approve a stronger plan. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
By a vote of 258 to 157, the House approved the Democrats' bill, which requires Congress to act within a specified time period whenever the president sends a message to lawmakers that he disapproves of an item in an appropriations bill. Congress might approve or reject the president's action by a simple majority vote. Republicans said the Democrats' version is a sham. They wanted to make it tougher for Congress to overrule the president by requiring a two-thirds vote in both the House and Senate. The line item veto would allow the president to cut individual spending items in appropriations bills approved by Congress. Currently, the president has the constitutional authority to veto an entire bill, but not its individual parts. The House bill now goes to the Senate, where it is opposed by several key senators. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Officials at the UN say that a military transport plane crashed in the northern part of Afghanistan, and apparently all 76 people on board were killed. The crash occurred earlier this week, but the wreckage was not found until today. The plane was Soviet-built, and the cause of the crash has not been determined. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Leah Delaria is proud to call herself a dyke. She titled her comedy album Bull Dyke in a China Shop. Delaria recently made a bit of TV history on the Arsenio Hall Show when she became the first out-of-the-closet lesbian comic on late-night TV to do stand-up about being a lesbian. In her act, she said she knew what would happen when her mother heard her on TV.
And I know exactly what she's going to say. She's going to go, why do you have to say you're a homosexual on national TV like that? Why do you have to do that? Why do you have to say that? I mean, everyone heard you. The neighbors heard you. The priests heard you. Everyone heard you. I can't believe it. And it's bad enough you have to say you're a homosexual, but why do you have to call yourself a dyke? That's such an ugly, mean, nasty word, that word dyke. It's a terrible, nasty, mean, ugly word, that word dyke. I just hate that word. It's a terrible, nasty, mean, awful, ugly, terrible, ugly. Oh, wouldn't you rather be a nice lesbian? Lesbian, okay? I wouldn't. I can't call myself lesbian. I can't use that word. I hate that word. It's such a technical, clinical word, isn't it? It sounds like someone you call to repair things in your home, doesn't it? It's like, honey, the refrigerator's on the fritz. Ready to get the lesbian. I can't do it. And I won't call myself a homosexual either. Ugh, because that would be gross. It would be gross. I think of that word homosexual much like I think of the word Negro. You know what I mean? It's like, let's go down to the river and sing some old homosexual spirituals. Somewhere.
So listen, was your mother really upset about you saying you were a dyke on national TV? And was she even more upset by saying that you said that she was upset?
I warned her. I called her and told her I was going to say that. But you know, I have to tell you, Terry, I was raised in an Italian Catholic family, okay? Which makes it very difficult to be queer because Italians believe that, you know, not Italians, but Catholics believe that if you ignore something, it'll go away. It'll disappear, okay? So when I came out to my parents, you know, we did the whole, like, we did the screaming, the fighting, the yelling, the throwing things, you know, that Italians do, and then they just forgot about it, you know? So we would have to do it, like, every month, you know? It's like, I have to do it again and again and again and again. They keep bringing men home for me to, you know, strange men. They bring them into the house, you know, like, Leah, meet Bob. I'd be like, what is this? Remember that conversation we had last month? You throw a dinette through the window. You remember that? It's like, I am not interested in Bob, okay? So the whole dyke thing, we've been going through this for years, you know what I mean? And since I've been standing on stage for what, 10, 11 years now, talking about being a lesbian, and a dyke is my word of choice, talking about that, my mom and dad have started to mellow into it a little bit more. I have to say that doing like The World According to Us for PBS last year, being on 2020 last year, but now definitely being on the Arsenio Hall Show has made all the difference. You know what I mean? There's a certain sort of validation that you get from the media, and it helps your little old Italian straight parents get it a little better.
Mm-hmm. My daughter may be a dyke, but she's a dyke on national TV.
Thank you very much.
Do you think of yourself as having a comic persona on stage?
A comic persona on stage? Well, God, I would hope so. I mean, that's the whole idea of why I'm there.
Describe Leah on stage.
Yeah. Okay. Leah on stage is, if you meet Leah in person, do you remember when this was, I guess it was Oral Roberts a few years ago, said he had seen a 600-foot Jesus Do you remember this? I remember this distinctly.
I don't.
He talked
Go
about,
on.
He had a vision. He saw a 600-foot Jesus, okay, which I was wondered, how did he know it was Jesus? If it was 600 feet tall, he saw Jesus' big toe, okay? So who could have been? But he says he saw a 600-foot Jesus. That's what I'm like on stage. When you meet me in person, I'm a certain way. And then once I get on stage, I'm the 600-foot Jesus. I'm the 600-foot Leah. I'm just Leah exaggerated a million times.
Describe how you dress on stage.
How I dress on stage. I do a lot of different costume changes and things on stage. So when I'm just Leah, when Leah Delaria has been hired to come in and say do 15 minutes, I like to really play with gender. So what I'll usually do is I'll wear a really nice suit, you know, kind of a double-breasted man's suit, and then I'll wear like a black bra and lipstick and do my hair really nice. You know what I mean? So I play with gender. If I wear a dress, I like to wear army boots with it, like big old boots with it. Like sometimes, like for, I do a thing called Ms. Delaria's Dating Tips for Dykes, and in that I wear a pink taffeta ball gown and big Doc Martin boots, you know, because I like to play with gender and dress and what people look like.
I have to say, I think there are two completely different Leah Delarias.
I'm a Gemini.
Yeah.
Well, that's
listen,
why.
As a comic, you have this loud, abrasive, raunchy, in-your-face style.
Uh-huh.
But in your performances, you also sing. And when mm-hmm. you sing a ballad, there's a completely different side of you that comes across. Mm-hmm. Excuse all the S's here, but you're kind of sensitive and sultry, subtle. And to show what I mean here, I'm going to play a ballad, Why Don't You Do Right, from your album, Bull Dyke in a China Shop.
Go ahead.
You have plenty of money, 1922. You let all the women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right? Like some other men. Here and bring me some money too. You're sitting here, you're wondering what it's all about. You don't pay the rent, they're going to throw you out. Why don't you do
really nice.
I can't believe you made me listen to that.
Well, how do you reconcile these two extremes in your personality?
Well, I'm a Gemini. That's one thing. And, you know, it was very calculated when I incorporated music into what I did. The reason being, when I first walked out on stage in 1982 and started saying, you know, dyke, and started... I walked out on stage, I started talking about my menstrual period in 1982. That was not done by women comics. Now it's kind of passé 11 years later, but in 1982, I was, if not the first, one of the first women to ever talk about something like that. And it was scary for people. And then, of course, I was one of the first people to actually say the word dyke and talk about being queer on stage. Also scary for people. I mean, it was like extreme. It would somewhat put audiences off. My idea was, if I could go out, sing a really sweet jazz song, something that people are familiar with, because that's what I am. I'm a jazz singer. Sing something that people are familiar with that would put them at ease. Then I could start going, dyke, woo, 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 you know, like that. And they would accept it a little better.
Did you ever try to make it as a singer before turning to comedy?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of settings?
Oh, I played in cabaret rooms and nightclubs and out in the open at women's music festivals and things like that.
Now, when you were doing cabarets and nightclubs, how did you dress?
This was before I actually came out. So in those times, I would wear a dress because that was the kind of dress code that I was forced to wear in those places.
Comic Leah Delaria is my guest. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. back with comic Leah Delaria. She has an album, by the way, called Bull Dyke in a China Shop. You talk about yourself as having Tourette's when it comes to telling people that you're out. No matter where you are, you're kind of screaming that you're out, always telling people who you are. So what was it like when you weren't out professionally, in those days when you were singing in a dress and nightclubs and you were not, you were not out?
Right. It was, you know, the thing is, I grew up in the Midwest, okay? I grew up in a little town that has been surrounded by an information-proof shield since about 1958, okay? And that's Belleville, Illinois. And so that's where I was doing this singing, right? Still kind of under in the home of my parents, in the Catholic town, the little, you know, there I am, like the littlest Bull Dyke. I knew I was gay, but I didn't tell anybody else that I was gay. So it was a really, there was a, like a huge sigh of relief, you know, that I let out when I made the decision that from now on, I'm gonna walk out on stage and I'm gonna be who I am. I was able to like look at the mirror, look at myself in the mirror every morning, brush my teeth, and like who I see. You know, it wasn't like I had to constantly worry about who was gonna find out anymore. Or that the owner would find out and that I would be out of a job. The owners know now the second I walk in, you know. And back then it was like when they hired me knowing that I was going to talk about being gay. So I didn't have to worry about losing my job anymore, you know.
Now, how did you start doing comedy?
I've always been funny and... even in school, you know, like I went to Catholic school, which is the best training ground for a comic that there is. You learn, my generation, you learned how to make that nun laugh, and then she wouldn't beat the heck out of you, you know what I mean? So I was really good at making that nun laugh. That hand would come my way, and I was like, and did you hear the one about, you know, at that sister? But so I had a lot of training growing up around that. My family is all really funny. My father's a cornball, and my mom is really kind of dry sense of humor. So I like to think that I have the perfect marriage of both their senses of humor, you know, kind of a cornball, wild, dry thing that happens. And people always said, try it. So back, and this is kind of a little bit of gay history, back in the early 80s in San Francisco, there was a club called the Valencia Rose, started doing gay comedy nights on Monday nights. I went there, and when it was very funny because it was gay comedy open mic, and there was like a mime. There was... a folk singer. There was a poet. And I'm sitting in the audience going, there were no comics. And there were two comics. There was the MCs, a woman by the name of Carol Roberts and a guy named Tom Amiano. Tom has continued through, and Carol doesn't do it anymore, but Tom has continued and become a very good comic. At that time, in the beginning, he was awful. And he'll be the first to admit it. He had no experience, and he was terrible. But now he's hilarious. And I thought, I watched both he and Carol, and I thought, I could do better than that. And I went home, and I put together 10 minutes of material. I put in some stuff that I had been working on about my period, and then totally queer stuff, and stuff about going to Catholic school, and walked up on stage the following week and killed. The audience loved me. The owner came up and Tom came up and Carol came up and said, are you going to come back next week? And I just started coming back every week, writing new material, doing things. And after a little bit, they asked me to MC. Carol left. They asked me to fill her spot. And I became the MC there. I worked there every two and a half years, every Monday and every other Saturday. And when you're performing steadily like that for kind of a repeat audience, you write material, you hone your craft.
When you started at the gay club,
the Valencia Rose,
yeah, and there were you know mimes and folk singers, and you come out and you start doing your routine about menstruation and tampons and probably talking about sex a lot. Were people offended at all by your not only your material but your kind of loud, you know, in-your-face style of performing?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, lesbians were used to, like, we're all women and we love one another, you know, and is life really grand? And I'm going, life isn't grand. Life sucks. And this is why, you know. And I tell him all the reasons. Because, you know, back then, I've changed quite a bit. I've been sober for about 3.5 years. And it's changed my comedy and the way I approach life and the way I approach comedy a little bit. But back then, I was the quintessential angry young woman, you know. I was 23 when I first walked out on stage, and I was really angry, and I was a punk. I had a bald head, and I had safety pins, and I was in their face. And these poor little lavender lesbians, they did not know what to do with me. So, yes, I offended them. It became, after I'd been at it for about 5 years, you know, there was a distinct line that was drawn, you know. I always like to think of the world as drawn into two camps, people who are pro-Sinatra and people who are anti-Sinatra, you know. So in the lesbian community, it was drawn into two camps. It was people who were pro-Leah and people who are anti-Leah. For a really long time, they always like called me the bad girl of lesbian comedy, and that was kind of my thing. I was the one who was going to go out there with the foul mouth and just not care, and no sacred cow person. There are no sacred cows, and I would go out and tell them that, you know. So they were women that were really freaked by me. What I see has happened is, in some ways, I've meld with age. I've really started to look at the world through more of a sense, with more of a sense of humor, and
less
that's
anger.
One thing, and less anger. And what's happened is the community has gotten a lot angrier. So we've met somewhere in the middle. You know what I mean? With ACT UP and Queer Nation, if you can imagine, that's going down my anger some a little bit from where it was. With ACT UP and Queer Nation and my mellowing out a little bit, the community and has kind of caught up with my anger a little bit. My anger is backed up to be where theirs is. And now we're kind of all in the same place. There's still a lot of people that I offend. There are a lot of people that do not want me to use the F word. You know, they get really uptight when I use the F word. My stance on that is I'm a woman, and women are not supposed to say that word. We are supposed to look like perfect little ladies, and we're not supposed to scream, and we're not supposed to holler, and we're not supposed to sweat. So when I go out on stage and I'm screaming and I'm hollering and I'm sweating and I'm using that word, I am challenging what society says women are supposed to behave like. So that's why I do it.
Leah Delaria, her recording of comedy and music, Bull Dyke in a China Shop, is on Lady Slipper. She plans a return visit to the Arsenio Hall show May 17th. Also in the works is an off-Broadway show. This is Fresh Air. Today is President Clinton's 100th day in office. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, will you be assessing the president's performance on All Things Considered?
You bet, Terry. Mara Liasson has that story. Also, Linda Wertheimer has been reporting from along Route 50 out in the country about how people feel about the Clinton presidency so far, and tonight she reports from Missouri. I'll have a conversation with Gary Glitter. He sold 38 million records around the world over the past 20 years. He is best known in this country for a song called Rock and Roll Part 2, which is played at National Basketball Association games and at hockey games. Mr. Glitter has never had a chance to hear his song played in a U.S. sports arena.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Croatian journalist Slavenka Dragulic is one of the leading voices telling the world about what has happened in Eastern Europe over the past few years, especially about what has happened in the former Yugoslavia. Her collection of essays, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed, was published last year. Book critic John Leonard has a review of her new collection, The Balkan Express.
It's been 15 months since Slavenka Dragulic's first collection of essays. But it was also a whole war ago between Croatians and Serbians, before there was even a Slovenia, back when she still wondered what a newly liberated Eastern Europe might mean for women and other human beings. And because her latest batch of Conversations with the Reader only goes through May 1992, she doesn't know the worst yet. She can't really imagine Bosnia. She hasn't thought about rape as an agency of ethnic cleansing. She has only glimpsed the beginnings of the cowardice and cynicism of the Western democracies. Bloodthirsty history itself seems doped up on amphetamines. Nevertheless, telling us about her mother and her daughter, and a boy who learned to kill, and an actress who used to be a friend, and a refugee who insisted on buying high-heel shoes, about air raid warnings, border crossings, and atrocities, this time Dragulic isn't laughing. She reports from the war as if from a volcano, on the lava and the ash. As much as Muslims, all women are victims in the Balkans, and so is the self, personhood. Draculich at first accuses herself of collaborating in the war by denying that it could happen and that it was happening, by failing to imagine a different future and not working to make a gentler one, by continuing to drink cappuccino and to shop, by being impatient with and even disdainful of refugees in Zagreb, by succumbing to a numbness of the inner being. To her daughter, she tries to explain how come the war came to the most liberal and best of all possible communist countries, the only non-profit police state in Sovietized Europe where citizens actually retained a few freedoms. The answer, she says, is so simple that I'm almost ashamed of it. We traded our freedom for Italian shoes. We had a passport, the possibility to travel, and we had enough surplus money with no opportunity to invest in the economy and no outlet but to exchange it on the black market for hard currency and then go shopping. Yes, shopping, to the nearest cities in Austria or Italy. It seems to me now to have been a kind of contract with the regime. We realize you are here forever. We don't like you at all, but we'll compromise if you let us be, if you don't press too hard. We didn't build a political underground of people with liberal democratic values ready to take over the government. Not because it was impossible, but on the contrary, because the repression was not hard enough to produce the need for it. This, I submit, is more intelligent than anything we've heard on television from the pancaked media heavies in their beltway blister packs or seen in the newspapers from the canned opinionizers of the think tanks. But Draculich knows perfectly well that war is more than a punishment for shopping. She also knows it isn't some sort of natural calamity come down inevitably on us, like a flood or plague or our destiny, as so many of her fellow Croatians seem to feel. War, as she reports from various fronts, is rape and gouged out eyes and buckets of testicles, dead silence, empty cities, and the sky itself an enemy. Whiteness, absence, weariness, resignation, and revulsion. All borders and no home. The war, she says, is grinning at you from your own face. I believe her. You will too.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Balkan Express by Slavinka Draculich, spelled D-R-A-K-U-L-I-C. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Serbian dissident writer Svetlana Slapsak and Bosnian writer Zoran Mutic. They just received the Pen Freedom to Write Award. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.